It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold, filling in for Rob Ferret today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, it's Food Friday. This week, if you're getting tired of squash soup and meatloaf this winter, well, a little citrus might help. In fact, a Meyer lemon might help. We'll find out more about that.
But first, Wisconsin Senator Kathleen Vinehout won't be running as Democratic candidate in this fall's gubernatorial election. She says she decided not to run after breaking her arm in a car crash last month.
This news almost guarantees that there will not be a Democratic primary. Here to talk about this announcement and what it could mean for Wisconsin in the fall is Joe Heim. He's a professor of political science at UW La Crosse. Joe Heim, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Mike.
Now, there had been some discussion about Senator Vinehout's arm for some time. Were you surprised by this news?
Not really. I think for obvious reasons, she's had a number of surgeries. Clearly, the damage to the auto accident was much more extensive than just simply a broken arm.
Now,
she's got physical therapy and further surgeries to do, apparently.
Now, this pretty much means there won't be a Democratic primary. Is that right?
Yeah, it's less and less likely as every day goes by. right now, most of the major candidates that would have been thought about had pulled out of the races, simply decided they weren't going to run. It doesn't necessarily preclude somebody getting in at the last minute, but the odds are a little bit against that as time goes on.
Is there anybody that you could think of just off the top of your head that might get in seeing an opportunity like this? Or?
Well, there was a businessman from Dane County that talked about running early on, and he would have been self-financed. I don't recall his name offhand. The minority leader of the assembly, I think he talked about possibly running at one time. But Kathleen Falk, of course, is always out there as a possibility. But really, for the most part, the bigger candidates, the heavyweights, had already pulled out.
Now, this sounds like this could be good news for Mary Burke. What do you think about that? Because she's the Democratic candidate for governor now, I guess.
I suspect that she's a little bit relieved at this. It gives her a little more time to develop her case and get around the state and more of her own time. A primary might have had the potential for pushing her faster than she's ready to do. She would have had to campaign, first of all, against another Democrat, and it would essentially take her focus off of attacking the governor, going after the governor. So she's probably relieved overall. I think, although I suspect she's not going to say too much about it, other than maybe kind words for Kathleen Vinehout.
Now, there's some people who think that the primary would have been good for Mary Burke, though, right?
I think it would have, frankly. I'm a supporter of primaries. I think it's a very healthy part of democracy. I think in particular for Mary Burke, it would have been advantageous. It would have honed up her image, sharpened up her campaign skills. I'm sure you know she's not ever run a statewide race. So I think it would have been very healthy for her name identification, for example. She's not that well known, frankly, in the state. So having a contest could have been very healthy for her. The negatives, some people argue that you spend too much money in a primary. I've always believed that that money spent in a primary pays off in November.
Now, it's possible that one of the things that would have come out in a primary race is probably the same thing that appears to already be coming out from the Republican side is the discussion about money and politics to some extent. I mean, Senator Kathleen Vinehout was very sort of focused on the idea of keeping money out of the election, and that probably would have been an issue. And the Republicans are referring to Mary Burke now as a Madison millionaire. So do you think that having that discussion in the primary would have helped strengthen Burke had she won the primary in a governor's race?
It would have cleared the air a little bit. Instead of simply naming her like a Madison liberal or a Madison millionaire, through a primary process of her getting herself out, she would have been better known. And, Herb Cole, for example, was a multimillionaire many times over, but it never bothered people because they knew him and they liked him. And this would have given Mary Burke a chance to kind of get her name across, and people would realize that she's not necessarily some millionaire that is well above other people. So it's that issue probably has been laid to rest. The reality is, however, that the governor is very likely going to outspend Mary Burke, even if she does use her own personal resources. She's been fairly successful at raising money so far, and I think that was one of the challenges that Kathleen Vinehout faced, raising the kind of money you have to do to run a statewide campaign.
Another thing that the some Republicans mentioned today is that in some ways Mary Burke would be returning to the former policies of former Governor Jim Doyle because she was part of his administration. Do you think that's going to be a theme that will run through the campaign this year?
Yes, I do. I think that's we made a major shift in Wisconsin policy when Governor Walker was elected. There's no question about that. And like it or not, basically some people are going to like it, some people are not, but he can point to the past and say, you know, we're moving on to the future and we don't want to go back to the past. Governor Doyle was not terribly unpopular when he left office, but partly because of the economy at that time, I think it gave a little bit of a negative image to his campaign. Mary Burke being in the administration, you know, obviously she can be labeled a Doyle supporter, another Doyle person, and to the degree that that's a negative, that's going to be one of the themes in this race.
How do you think this news affects the Governor Walker's campaign?
I think it's going to allow him to focus. He's already done this, by the way. He's got pretty much a focus on Mary Burke, and I think he thought all along, and his campaign thought all along, that she would be the candidate, and he's already in his candidate. The Republican Party have been attacking her pretty regularly. So it allowed them to focus more on her rather than worry about whether it's going to be Kathleen Vinehout or Mary Burke. This way they could focus their attention on her. And if they want to start running ads, if they have a lot of money to do this, they certainly know where they're going at this point.
Do you think that there will be any issues that will be lost with Kathleen Vinehout out of the race?
Yeah, that's a possibility. It would have been I frankly would have looked forward to a primary engagement between the two. You have a sitting state senator versus, frankly, a pretty newcomer. You have a more of a moderate and maybe somewhat more liberal. Somebody has more experience, basically. I think it would have been a pretty fascinating race, frankly, between the two of them. And I was looking forward to it.
So I think we've kind of squashed this entirely, but do you think there's any chance at all that there could be a Democratic primary? Is there any chance that somebody could step forward at this point, do you think?
It's, as I said, it's less and less likely. One of the interesting things about this whole Mary Burke candidacy is how quickly the party elites jumped on her bandwagon. And she was well ahead with financing. She had a lot of endorsements from state legislators and some of the hierarchy of the party. And Kathleen Vinehout really had very little of that. So she had a head start, basically. And I think that gives her an advantage in the sense of essentially running a race at her own pace.
Well, Joe, thanks so much for speaking with us today about this.
Oh, sure. My pleasure.
That was Joe Heim. He's a professor of political science at UW La Crosse.
Up next, it's Food Friday. We'll get the scoop on all different kinds of recipes made with Meyer lemons, including salsa and ceviche. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. When we think about winter, we often think about things like soup, squash, macaroni and cheese. We don't think about lemons.
But on this Food Friday, we're talking about a very special kind of lemon that's only available around January. It's the Meyer lemon.
And one of our in-house foodies here at WPR, Lori Skelton, spent this week making all kinds of treats with Meyer lemons. I mean, you could smell it in the hallways. And she's here to share some recipes with us. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
It is good to be back, especially with this kind of a wonderful ingredient.
Now, what exactly is a Meyer lemon?
These were, quote, discovered in China in 1908 by someone that the Department of Agriculture had sent to Asia to find new plants. And Frank Meyer found this particular tree that was actually only being used as a decorative houseplant in China. It has little lemons on it. They're about half the size of the lemons that we are used to. The skins are very thin. You can actually eat the peel because there's not a lot of that bitter white pith in them. The acid content is lower, and the taste itself, while it's a true lemon, it's a sweeter lemon.
Now, where did they grow these things?
They were in almost everyone's backyard in California up until about 1950. There was a virus that wiped out almost every Meyer lemon and did actually wipe out a lot of the citrus crop in California then. They found a strain that was virus resistant, and that's what's being grown. But because those skins are so thin, they don't ship very well. So they don't show up in Wisconsin that often. I discovered them at a co-op years ago, and have been fortunate to keep an eye on them ever since. They're one of my favorite things to liven up, as you say, dull winter recipes.
Yeah, we are going to miss your week preparing for Meyer lemons. I got to say that much. It's been a blast and such a tasty blast. I think of Meyer lemons, and I've only known about them for a few years, as more fragrant and perfumey than an ordinary lemon. How would you describe them, though?
Some people have said that they remind them of flowers. Perfume did come up when we were doing... We actually did a taste-off this week where I made a pan of lemon bars with regular lemons and a pan with Meyer lemons. And the Meyer lemons did come off as sweeter, a lighter texture. And some people did like that perfumey, or in some cases that green herb is mm-hmm. what they were saying. It is, for some palates, a lighter flavor. And for the lemon bars, it actually turned out about half and half. Half of our taste testers loved that delicate, perfumey essence. And some of them said, I'm sorry, if it's a lemon bar, I want a big citrus punch.
And it was actually very unscientific, too, right? It was just random people who walked up. But I liked the Meyer lemons. I thought they were good.
The texture was a little bit different, more of a custard, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that has to do, again, with that lower acidity, which is one of the reasons why Meyer lemons are so great in desserts that have cream. And you have some Meyer lemon ice cream in front of you right now. Here's the lovely thing about Meyer lemon ice cream. In this recipe, I had a cup of half and half, 3 cups of cream, and nearly a cup of juice. Now, that's a lot of liquid, but it only required a cup of sugar. So if you are looking to scale back on just how much sugar you take in at this time of year, Meyer lemons might be a really great way to go. Meyer lemon baked custard, so easy to do and such a great thing to add. And so what do you think about the ice cream?
The ice cream rocks my world. I'm serious. This might be the best ice cream. I mean, I love fruity ice creams, but this ice cream is amazing. It is perfumey and fragrant, but it's also, I don't know, there's just something... Je ne sais quoi about it, Laurie.
Well,
what is it? What
makes
is
you
it?
Want to speak French. That, it's not very sweet either.
It's not,
nice.
It's not cloyingly sweet. A lot of times, if you run into a lemon flavored something in the supermarket, it's got that metallic taste mm-hmm. on the finish when you're not dealing with a really good lemon flavor. And so, no, you're not going to have that sickening sweetness to it. But it's certainly sweet enough. What you might be catching is, the batch of ice cream I made did have some cardamom in it. I got that recipe from the LA Times. I will be honest, as much as I love cardamom, I don't really taste it. And next time I might up the cardamom factor. But that may be what you're getting. The sweetness, the perfume of the lemon can certainly play off that perfume in cardamom, that real nose tingling.
Yeah. Yeah, it works well with the ice cream. And we should point out that I think all of these recipes are posted on our Facebook page. You've been experimenting and cooking all week. And another one of the greatest hits of the week has been today's offering, besides the ice cream, and it was the Meyer lemon salsa. Tell us about that.
This is something that Susan Goyne of the L.A. restaurant Luke came up with. This is one of the hot spots for Mediterranean dining in Los Angeles, and she serves this with just about any firm white fish. I actually brought in some shrimp to saute, and it's the Meyer lemon chopped up, again, with the peel, a little bit of chopped green olive, a little bit of chopped shallot, a little bit of parsley, and a little bit of vinegar to brighten it, a little bit of salt and pepper, and a little bit of olive oil. And it just played beautifully with that shrimp.
I was initially afraid of it, actually. When I first heard that you were making salsa out of lemons with the hunks of lemon peel in it, it disturbed me. But then when I ate it, it was really good. It was really good.
We had some people say it might work also with a roasted duck or chicken.
Yeah, and white fish. I could see it working with that. Really
and well. One person suggested, I thought this was brilliant, suggested you use that salsa instead of pickle relish on a hot dog.
Oh, yeah, that's a great idea.
I thought that was brilliant. So yeah. That and then one person even said they'd eat it straight out of the bowl with not even a chip.
Oh, no, I can understand that. And again, I mean, it's one of those things where it sounds a little bit weird, you know, the idea of having lemon peel in your salsa, But it's such a thin peel, it's actually pretty easy to eat. Yeah. And it's delicious. I mean, it really is pretty good.
Of course, the peel is where you're going to get the lemon oil, which will, again, carry that flavor one step further.
Hmm.
So if you're using the peel of the lemon, as you did in that salsa, do you have to do anything special to prepare the lemon, scrub it down like you would with a potato peel or anything?
No, actually, you don't. You know, certainly give them a wash in case there is a little residual something on them from the store. But no, you sharpen your knife so you can get a nice fine cut and chop it up like it's an apple. It really works beautifully.
Excellent. Well, in keeping in with our seafood theme, there was another recipe that you tried, and this was bold also. This is a Meyer lemon ceviche.
Do you eat ceviche often?
I had my first ceviche about a month ago, so
no,
not
I'm
often.
Sorry.
But
I don't know what ceviche is. I'm just completely lost. What is a ceviche?
Go home, Mike.
It's basically one step up from sashimi. You're taking good grade raw fish, and instead of eating it raw, you are letting a citrus of some sort play with the protein.
Oh,
you're
wow.
not quite cooking it. It's not quite like adding heat or searing it, but you are changing the structure of the protein so that it's safe to eat. I love ceviche, and I love scallops, but I usually find that ceviche tends to overpower that delicate fish. I thought sweeter lemon would have to be the perfect match for it. Here again, very minimal ingredients, red pepper flakes, a little parsley, a little garlic, olive oil, lots of Meyer lemon juice, and then chop up your scallops, let them sit in the Meyer lemon juice for about 15 minutes, and then you toss it with the olive oil mixture, like a chimichurri. And again, it seemed to go over really, really well for those who love ceviche and for those who never had it.
So I take it you did not try that yesterday, Mike.
No, I completely
missed
it.
You missed that one. Yeah, that
I
was
didn't even know what it was, so I was confused. Yeah, anyway.
Yeah. It was another beautiful one. Something about the Meyer lemon seems to pair well with seafood.
It's, I think, the delicate nature of it. For some people who, again, love that real solid note of a citrus punch, that's one way to go. But if you are afraid of having your other flavors overpower a really good piece of fish, Meyer is a really good way to start playing with citrus and seafood.
So basically what we were doing this whole week is you were taking situations where you'd normally have, you know, your average grocery store lemon. I don't even know if they have names.
Eureka is the one that I think shows up most in Wisconsin.
So those are those big kind of knobby ones. Those are Eureka lemons. And you replace them with Meyer lemons and to see exactly where you found the best matches. What blew your mind personally as a cook?
What surprised me was the first time I encountered Meyer lemons, I was using them in a simple butter sauce to jazz up boring winter vegetables, root vegetables. And I love them in vegetables. I was a little bit surprised at how much I enjoyed them outside of seafood with meats that were a little bit sturdier. I had a little bit of sausage in the freezer, tried it at home, and it was a lovely pairing.
You put lemon in sausage? Really?
Just a little bit on the side. That was actually a suggestion from the British cook Nigel Slater. He does a fried sausage sandwich and he grates lemon zest on top of it. And I thought it was a little bit odd at first, but it was really, really pleasant. Lemon and pork was not something I was expecting to like. And this was an absolute delight.
Wow.
See, Mike, Nigel does it.
Exactly. If Nigel does it, it must be great. I am really blown away at how versatile the Meyer lemon is. So why do we only get it just a couple months a year?
Again, these are on the delicate side, so it's hard to ship them commercially. There are places where you can mail order your own lemons. If you feel like dealing with 10 pounds of lemon at a time, you can, you know, hit the internet, and there's a number of places to mail order.
There are lemon dealers?
Yes, there are. And if you do find yourself with an abundance of Meyer lemons, if you can't use them all up at once, they are amazing. If you zest them and put some of the lemon zest in the bottom of the ice cube tray and then put your juice on top of that. That way you get to hang on to all of that great flavor, even if you can't use it all immediately. So yes, once you've frozen your blocks of juice and zest. Once they're solid, you take them out, put them in a sturdy bag, leave them in the freezer for whenever you decide to get creative with
the
juice.
That's a really good idea. Could you also just do cubes of straight-up Meyer lemon juice? Would that last?
Of course. But there's something about having the lemon oil that's delivered in fresh zest that I really like hanging on to.
Well, Lori, thanks for being here with us. That was Lori Skelton, one of the WPR in-house foodies. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll talk to a reporter about his investigation into what's being called dark money and how it can keep donors to political campaigns hidden.
We'll also get a rundown of what's going on at this year's Detroit Auto Show.
And we'll talk about the benefits of volunteering to commemorate the Day of Service on Monday, which is Martin Luther King Day, Jr.
That's all coming up Monday on Central Time.
And don't forget, you can keep up with Central Time by following us on Facebook. You'll get tips on upcoming guests, and you can voice your thoughts and feelings there, too. That's Central Time on WPR. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a guest who says we should bring sacred values to the gun control debate if we want to reach a place of consensus on the issue. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. Coming up later in the program, we'll hear about the president's plan to reform the National Security Agency and talk about the future of privacy in the United States.
First, a look at gun violence and gun control. So far this year, two people in Wisconsin have died in gun-related murders. Today, Wisconsin Public Radio launches an ongoing series on gun murders in the state, tracking where and why they occur and following law enforcement and community groups' efforts to try and prevent them. Gilman Halstead has our first report.
The first gun murder of the year took place at the sidetracked bar in Wausau on January 3rd. According to police reports, the victim, 27-year-old Casey Christopher Elliott, was fighting in the bar parking lot with the suspect, 30-year-old John Lewis, when he was shot by what police believe was a .22-caliber semi-automatic handgun. The gun has not been recovered. Police say the two men knew each other and the suspect has served prison time for drug trafficking crimes. According to Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn, the apparent cause of this gun death fits the typical profile for gun murders in Milwaukee, where 85 people were shot to death last year.
Many of these things are just arguments and fights among two people who are both carrying firearms, and somebody pulls a gun, and we have a dead person.
Milwaukee police are now investigating the first shooting death of the year in that city, the second in the state. A 20-year-old man was killed on Wednesday on the city's south side. Yesterday, police arrested an 18-year-old suspect in that murder. In 2012, the last year for which statewide figures are available, two-thirds of the 166 murders in the state involved a gun. 61% of the perpetrators were between the age of 18 and 34, as were 48% of the victims. And Mallory O'Brien of the Milwaukee Homicide Review Commission says usually both the victim and the suspect have a criminal record.
For 2013, looking at the victims and suspects of homicide, 76% of the victims have an arrest history and 93% of the suspects have an arrest history.
That's a small consolation to the families of the victims and to the people who live in the neighborhoods where the murders happen. Betty, who gave only her first name, lives on the block where Wednesday's Southside Milwaukee murder took place.
Crime is always everywhere in the Southside. I think they should put like cameras in each block and have more cops, I guess, driving around.
Milwaukee police have used cameras to deter shootings in some city taverns where several gun crimes have occurred. But this week, the city got funds from the state to expand the use of microphones to record the sound of gunshots in crime-prone neighborhoods. Chief Flynn says the ShotSpotter technology is already helping police solve a problem that has hampered investigations in the past.
The data produced by the ShotSpotter technology told us an alarming truth. In some of our neighborhoods, the most gunfire-afflicted neighborhoods particularly, only 14% of the shots fired incidents were being called into 911.
Technology like this is one way police are trying to reduce gun deaths. On the legislative front, a bill designed to reduce the number of domestic violence gun deaths could get a vote before the end of the year. According to Tony Gibbert of End Domestic Violence Wisconsin, a preliminary report for last year found guns were used in 19 domestic violence murders. He says the new law would require courts to verify that anyone with a domestic violence restraining order immediately surrender any guns they own.
We know that some counties are starting to do this, but most counties do not have any kind of active enforcement procedure in place. And we do see throughout the years homicides that seemingly could have been prevented had there been more active enforcement.
Gibbard says that bill has not been scheduled for a vote yet. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now we take a look at the national debate over gun control. Despite numerous mass shootings in the past few years, both sides of the debate have been unable to establish a productive dialogue about gun control in the country.
And our next guest wonders if maybe it's time to shift the way we frame the debate, trying a technique used in international conflict resolution that focuses on shared human values or sacred human values.
Joining us now is Tim Phillips. He's co-founder of Beyond Conflict, an international organization that advocates for peace and reconciliation. He wrote a recent opinion piece for Global Post about it, and we've got a link to the article on the Central Time Facebook page. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
So you've worked in war-torn countries to try and negotiate an end to conflict, places like Northern Ireland, the Balkans, South Africa. How does what you've done abroad apply to the gun control debate in America?
Well, thank you. It's interesting. I'm actually speaking to you from London, where I'm attending a meeting with some leaders from South Africa who had been former enemies and really played a key role in negotiating the end of apartheid. And we're meeting with some people from some of the Arab Spring countries and people from both the Shia and Sunni communities. And we've been doing this sort of work for 22 years, trying to bring together people where there's no trust, where there's been not just conflict, but violence between the communities, and trying to find a way to get them to talk to each other. And that's been our work for 20 years, and it's what we're struggling with today in places like in the Arab Spring.
So you said what you're trying to do is get them to talk to each other. How do you get them to do that when these the conflicts and the history of violence and pain is so deep?
Well, that's the essential question. And I often say that in the DNA of our organization is this recognition that there's this shared human experience. One of the things we often find when we brought in the early 90s the two principal negotiators who negotiated the end of apartheid to Belfast, a lot of the leaders in both the Protestant and Catholic side said, how can we learn from people in South Africa, never mind El Salvador or anywhere else? Our situation is unique. Nobody understands what we've been through, and the divisions are too deep. And yet, when they forget these sort of superficial distinctions between the South African experience and Northern Ireland experience, and I don't mean to say they're superficial, but when they hear these leaders talk about that they came from a culture where there was no tradition of compromise, where there was such hate, and where everybody wanted to feel that they were right and try to impose their view on the other community, that in the example of Northern Ireland, hearing that from leaders who ended apartheid just a year or two earlier had a real impact on them. It made them think, well, if they could do that there in a much bigger context, why can't we do this here?
So you're talking about people getting together and sharing stories, their history, but also about their culture and their beliefs and what you know you might take for granted in day-to-day life. It sounds like this falls under the category of stuff that you call sacred values. Can we talk about that term and what it means?
Yes. So because of the work over the last 20 years, one of the most difficult problems, in whether it be in South Africa 20 years ago or even in Northern Ireland today, is this notion of identity and narrative. You know, what gives really birth to people's view of the world? You know, what is the family they come out of or the community they come out of? What do they hold sacred to their core identities? And, you know, a peace process, as in Northern Ireland, may be very important in stopping the violence, but it doesn't really address the underlying sort of grievances or identities that may have given birth to it in the future or in the past. You know, issues of exclusion, issues of marginalization, or issues of just inequality. And so in trying to address those issues, we came to realize that there are certain things that are not negotiable. There are certain things that people hold dear to their very identity, that they're almost, and not just almost sacred, but are sacred to them and to their community. And as we struggled with trying to understand this, we came across some writing that was done in the 1990s by some social psychologists who defined this notion of sacred values. And as I said in that commentary, that, you know, sacred values are somewhat obvious to people. You know, if you're a parent about your young child, you know, protecting them is sacred to you. There's not even a question about doing that. Or if you're a deeply religious person, the principles of your religion are above compromise. Or if you're a deeply patriotic person. So there are those things that accord to one's sense of morality that they would never compromise on it. What was interesting is in the 1990s, these psychologists were noticing that if somebody approached somebody who holds a sacred value by trying to, you know, bribe them with an economic payment or a regulatory approach or some trade-off, some material trade-off, that these people responded with moral outrage and more aggressively to that because they felt their core integrity was under threat. And what's interesting, in the last two or three years, some neuroscientists, particularly at Emory University, with the sort of evolution of neuroimaging technology, actually was able to demonstrate physically through brain scans and research that we actually process sacred values and considerations of them in different regions of the brain than more, let's say, material trade-offs. You know, whether or not you're going to sell your house, what price would you consider? But those are processed in the brain differently than if somebody's asking you to compromise a deeply felt religious belief or something that's really core to your identity.
Well, if you take a look at the gun debate and the sacred values that are involved here, you know, I don't know exactly what people would say, but I can imagine some people would say the right to bear arms is sacred to me, and it's important that I feel that I can protect my family. And somebody else might say, it's important to me to have stricter gun control laws because I need to protect my family, and fewer guns means I think my family is safer. So how does naming those, what you call sacred values, help at all? Because at the end of the day, you said them aloud, but they still exist.
Well, absolutely. And one of the things we learned in the work over the last 20 years is that it's important for people to own their own narrative. An identity. For whatever reason it was created, whether it was something they inherited as a family tradition or something they experienced in their life or the religion or nation they live in, these are things that individuals decide for themselves are sacred to them, and they don't really want to compromise over. And one of the great lessons that's been emerging in conflict resolution around the world is you have to both recognize that in another person and not try to tell that person who they are and what's right and what's wrong. And what we've seen is when people are recognized for having the value, that another person is validating it. They don't have to own it. They don't have to accept it. But they say, you know, I recognize this is sacred to you. I recognize this is important to you. And in doing so, the research and the experience shows that those people, because they're not being challenged to compromise their sacred value, literally start listening more. Doesn't mean you're trying to convince them to change their mind, but you get to a common ground where you can actually engage in a rational conversation. And because I've witnessed this over the years and currently trying to work on some of these approaches in some of the Arab Spring countries, as an American citizen who, you know, loves my country and cares deeply about it, when I see this sort of, you know, debate happening that's not on any rational ground, I thought, well, the same frame we use in international conflict, really, it's the human experience, really should be framed for this really important and increasing debate in the United States. And it's not to take a position. I mean, at one time, I used to teach rifle and shotgun at a camp when I was a teenager in my early 20s. I was a member of the NRA. So I'm not coming to this from a particular point of view or partisan point of view. I'm coming to this as somebody who has spent the last 25 years as an American, trying to help people figure out on their own how to resolve their conflict.
We're talking right now with Tim Phillips about bringing the concept of sacred human values into the gun control debate, and we'd like to hear from you about this. Do you think this would help to articulate what it is that we think is sacred when it comes to guns and gun control? And do you think we could ever get this to work in Washington? Can you mix the emotional human value side of things with politics? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're talking now with Tim Phillips, who has worked with an international agency to affect reconciliation in war-torn places. And we're talking about how to apply the idea of voicing sacred values to the gun control debate in America. Our guest says that it could be just the thing we need to move things along in a place where there seems to be gridlock. And we want to know what you think is sacred surrounding guns and gun control. Maybe we can try a little bit of this on the air right now. And do you think that it's possible to take something like this, talking about sacred human values, and apply it to politics? Will we ever get anywhere with that? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Tim, I want to ask you, when we're talking about sacred human values, for instance, it sounds like it's something that you might be discussing in a different setting. It's a little touchy-feely. It's the emotional landscape. It's the kind of stuff that people don't often volunteer freely, for instance. How will that ever be compatible with policymaking?
Well, that's a core question. I would say that, you know, over the last 6 months to a year, as I've seen the debate in the United States over gun control getting more and more vitriolic and more sort of divisive, I started thinking in terms of, well, to be honest, the approach that the administration or Mayor Bloomberg or other people have been taking doesn't recognize that for a lot of people, this may be a sacred value to them. And on the flip side, you know, for people who worry deeply about their children, and particularly the infants who were recently killed, that that may be a violation of their sacred value as well. And I thought, here are considerations that are deeply sacred to all sides, including people who, you know, view the Second Amendment as a very important sacred value. They also care deeply about their children. And it seemed to me that there was no recognition from both sides that these are sacred values for each side of the debate. And having applied the sacred value lens to some of the conflicts around the world, in finding that once people are allowed to own their own sacred value and nobody's trying to get them to compromise on it, they then start to engage rationally and say, okay, let's have a conversation and see if we can find common ground.
So it sounds like we weren't
doing this in our country.
So it sounds like you're saying once you can let go of this fear response that someone's going to try to take from you what you hold dearest, you realize that's not going to happen, then you can actually talk things through.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's where actually the neuroscience is interesting. They find that we cannot think rationally until we feel that our identities are understood and recognized by others. And that's actually biologically based. And so if a sacred value is so deeply sacred that it's by extension emotional, that until you feel safe that this sacred value of yours is being validated by others, doesn't mean the other side has to agree to it. But they recognize it. They say, yes, I understand this is sacred to you. I understand that this is important to you. And here's what's important to me. So if we can both respect that these things are important to us, then maybe we can have a conversation about finding common ground. And frankly, I don't see this happening on both sides in this debate. And until that happens, I don't think we can have a rational debate in this country about the Second Amendment, about gun control, safety, or whatever you want to call it. But that's a prerequisite in this country to have, I think, a very rational and considered discussion. And, you know, it's funny, we as Americans have been spending the last 20 years with all these transitions happening around the world trying to help other countries reconcile. And one of the greatest insights is this recognition of what's sacred to people. and we haven't been applying it here.
Let's get our callers in on this. We've got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you. We'll go first to Barry in Chicago. Hi, Barry.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay, how about you?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
What do you think about the idea of sharing sacred values?
Well, you know, I think it's a very valid point. Mr. Phillips points out something that I think, you know, would apply to any mediation between two opposing parties. I would only add, my particular comment is that what I've seen in these debates, particularly in gun control, and for the record, I'm on the pro-gun side, pro-liberty side, I would say, it comes to mind that we don't fully recognize what those sacred values are. Whenever I hear someone speaking on pro-gun control and they speak to me, they don't recognize what I'm saying. In fact, they don't hear me. It seems like they don't hear me. So I think, and I'm probably the same way when I'm listening to others and I consider my values more important. I consider the value of my personal liberty more important.
Okay. Well, let's start with there because there's plenty to chew on. Thank you for that call, Barry. And Tim, what about people not feeling heard when they do express themselves and their sacred values?
Well, I think Barry made a very good point, and there's another consideration, which is of bias. And one of the things we've found, and there's been research, you know, through cognitive science with bias, and it turns out that when we are biased against what somebody's telling us, we actually hear less. And we're biased towards something we want to hear, we actually hear more. And I don't mean just this empirically, but biologically, they can see the neural activity in the brain that increases when we're hearing something that supports our point of view, and we actually hear less when it doesn't. And, you know, this is, to me, was a revelation in the last 2 years about sacred values. And once they started showing this sort of biological basis for it, it struck me that that was critical to this policy debate in the United States and many issues, which is you really have to understand how people come to their sense of identity, which is really about their sense of feeling safe in the world. And you need to be heard, and you need to be understood, and only then can you have a rational conversation.
Let's take one more quick call. Tom from Oshkosh, you're next.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Great. My question comes to the application of spiritual principles and identifying them at the front end of a conversation so that some sense of unity in coming to the question of gun control can be achieved before you even speak of gun control and the emotions that it brings out.
Okay, well, thank you, Tom. Thanks for being brief there. And we've only got a little bit of time for your answer, Tim. What about spirituality involved in all of this?
Well, I mean, it's really key. I mean, spirituality is obviously unique to every individual, but it has some ancient roots, and even, quite frankly, from the research I've done long before established religion, this notion of what is sacred really is based on our sense of community. Of understanding the environment you live in, that their places became sacred because they gave us landmarks of security and identity. And over a period of time, that's evolved. And so, you know, I've said in this op-ed and also seen some of the response to it that this isn't to suggest an answer. This is to suggest a framework, which is to say you cannot have a conversation, whether it's about religious principles, somebody's sense of liberty and or safety on either side, until you recognize that people have to own these identities.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Tim, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Tim Phillips, co-founder of Beyond Conflict, an international organization that advocates for peace and reconciliation.
Coming up next, we'll talk about the president's plans to reform the National Security Agency. I'm Mike Arnold, filling in for Rob Ferrick.
I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.